spoke enough Spanish to bump her way through a sales transaction. When she was growing up, Abuela Lopez sometimes spoke to her in a southern Colorado dialect, almost archaic. Michael's family was from Bakersfield, making him useless unless you needed Spanish slang for a pussy and 40 ounce. Alicia checked that he was out of earshot when she asked, in her broken Spanish, for an herb called neem.
Para.
Alicia flashed the canary diamond on her left hand. Out of shame or conceit, she couldn't decide which. She then turned her back to Michael, pointing to her womb.
No se garantiza que funcione y también duele.
Alicia nodded.
Entonces ya lo sabe, said the clerk. Lo sabe mejor que yo.
No way! Michael hollered from across the botanica. This incense is made from, I shit you not, viper sperm. What the heck?
Alicia ignored him as the woman headed into the back room. The sounds of the radio cracked away from sports and into conjunto music. When the clerk reappeared, she held what looked like an urn and gave explicit directions to steep the leaves in boiling water for half an hour. Alicia said gracias, paying in cash. Outside, the moon was nearly full. Fleas? Michael asked as they walked toward the Nova, their shadows slim on the grainy amber-colored asphalt. He opened the passenger door with his key.
I don't like it when you lie, Sia.
She faced him, studied an L-shaped wrinkle across his cheek. I'm pregnant, I don't want it, the end.
You should tell Gary, if you haven't.
It's the right thing to do. Alicia turned away from Michael as he shut her inside the car. It was colder than before, the light shining in such a way that the moment seemed slow, as if time had slightly realigned to another beat. It's not really any of his business, she said. And it's none of yours either. They parked the Nova outside an abandoned adult theater on 23rd Street. The lot sloped into a cement trail that ran along the South Platte River, leading to the Union Pacific Rail Yard and Confluence Park, a spot where, over 150 years earlier, according to Alicia's freshman history class at UCD, Denver was founded when an Anglo named William Greenberry Russell discovered gold, and the city erupted. Before that, it was an Arapaho camp. Now it was a desolate hillside, filled with stoners and the homeless, flanked by multi-million dollar condos and public art. The new Queen City of the Plains. They moved toward the river, a row of Section 8 apartments on the left. Alicia remembered her first place after Abuela Lopez died and the bank took the house on Galapagos Street. It was a basement studio with subterranean windows and cruel lighting. Cobwebs and spider sacks appeared often. Alicia would open the window, shoot a stream of ammonia from a spray bottle, and break the sacks against the corrugated steel lining the glass. They never had problems with insects on Galapago. Though once, while riding her bike past the old house, Alicia saw an Anglo woman in a purple dress gingerly directing a group of exterminators through the yard. Watch your step, she had said. The new owners are still improving the foundation. Michael and Alicia halted before a human-sized cut in a chain-link fence. The whole of the Union Pacific rail yard was visible, an elegant expanse of routes sending trains north into Wyoming, east into Kansas, and west through mountain passes and whiteout valleys into Utah, a journey ending in California sunlight. Alicia loved the idea of her name riding so far. Not Alicia Del Toro Parker, but her tag name, K-SD, easily pronounced Cased. Michael reached for Alicia's hand, but she smacked him away. She climbed through effortlessly. He followed, the fence trembling. At the yard's western edge, they searched out a clean freight. Within the aisles of tracks, Michael and Alicia passed the ghost-like shapes of hoppers and field mice stalked by feral cats. The bodies of homeless men sunk into the jagged banks of the yard, their busted boots and clumped sleeping bags, gray mounds among the dirt. Michael lit a cigarette. Beneath the yard lights, his face seemed younger, his teeth ivory, his eyes shining. They continued on past empty cars with crude tags by amateurs. There were massive deco signatures, left by a long-standing Denver crew with gangbanger tendencies. Michael exhaled his smoke, pointing to a character tag, Snoopy, with chicken scratch beneath it, Mile High City. He hated this shit, and she agreed. They moved behind a yellow switcher where, some 20 yards ahead, was a water tower with a silhouette of a cased piece. Michael said, "All I remember was climbing that rickety ladder." He paused, adding, as if for good measure, "Your ass in front of me the whole way." "Good God, let's hit this train already." With their backpacks heavy, they rushed the tracks, the iron walls forming a canyon in the night. It was like old times, when they were young and Michael was enough. Alicia bumped him with her right shoulder. "I always think of you, Mikey. When a train rolls by my place at 1 a.m., it's all you." She loved the trains, how they charged forward, creating their own sense of time. "Me too," he said. "I hear the sounds of the tracks rattling, the horns blaring, and those caution gates getting lowered. It gets me all hot. Then I turn to the chick beside me in bed and say, 'This reminds me of my ex-girlfriend.'" Alicia stopped walking, her boots hitting the ground with a smack. "You're an asshole. I don't want to hear that." "Why not, Sia? You're the married one. Same dish every night." "I don't see why you have to jab, that's all." In the far distance, she spotted their freight, clean under shadows. A track pointed toward Kansas. "You don't know why?" Michael said. The first time, it was Michael's. Alicia was 19. At the King Supers on Spear Boulevard, she shoved an EPT box into her unseasonably warm coat and biked to the house she shared with her abuela Lopez. Alicia took the test in her upstairs bathroom, later emptying the wastebasket in a nearby park. A clinic doctor prescribed a pill that knifed Alicia's insides for 3 days and 2 nights. On the third day, dizzy and partially blind with pain, Alicia staggered into the kitchen where she found Abuela Lopez standing at the counter chopping pork with a butcher's knife. It was spring, the windows were open, the perfume of lilacs pushed into the house and mixed with the stench of raw meat. "Abuelita," she said, "I need to tell you something." Before Alicia could finish, Abuela Lopez missed the pork, slicing her right thumb, blood flowing over the meat. Abuela Lopez called her granddaughter many names that day. Selfish, cruel, stupid, childish. When she got the bleeding under control and her temper sealed away, she told Alicia, "Before all this bullshit, we only had the herbs, mija. Why didn't you ask me?" Abuela Lopez knew what plants to use, the temperature at which to sip the tea, how many cups for how many days, how long the cramps would curl Alicia's insides, and to what extent she should expect tenderness in her breasts. They agreed on the freight. Michael walked to one side while Alicia went to the other. She removed her gloves and ran her hands over the chilled steel. Weeks before, Alicia had planned her design, a navy signature centered with slim text, white gradient shading, a black circle in her K. Michael always told her that he didn't like cased much, that Alicia should write something else, something clearly feminine. But Michael's wasn't much better. Sloke. Who would write that? And what the hell did it mean? They pulled the cans of Rust-Oleum from their bags and began painting. It was odd how it worked.
Alicia did countless designs for work, but when it came to trains, some unknowable engine drove her hands. On more than one occasion, in more than one dirt lot, Alicia experienced the feeling of seeing her signature appear as if she had uncovered it beneath the dirty metal. With her scarf covering her nose and mouth, Alicia rested in the midst of her long dash, peeking around the car's edge at Michael, who never looked better than when he was riding. He worked his spray can gracefully, his dark eyes focused only on Sloak. In the triangular space between his outstretched arm and neck, a far-off street lamp formed a spiral of light. "How's it going?"
"Half finished. You still on your second letter?"
"My dash. The edges are so clean, so nice.
You wouldn't know about it."
Michael shook his can, started again.
"Oh, see ya. I know about that dash."
"You're an idiot."
"I know," Michael said with pride.
A low vibration rattled the track. A ghost train rolling. An engine firing. Michael and Alicia stiffened as they examined the rails. They once knew a kid who died in the yards. He wasn't much older than 16. It was the middle of summer, early at night. The bull hadn't come out to patrol. The kid was painting a train when he took a step back and a single freight rolled over him. Word spread among crews, and soon kids visited the unfinished signature, painting their wishes in black. A poem appeared. "May your journey be an endless track. May your trains keep rolling. May your name be completed when you're back." Alicia kicked the freight. A booming sound.
"Someone's been practicing."
"Get to work, Sia. Who knows the next time you'll get..." Light flashed over his face. Not the floodlights or the street lamps, but a concentrated stream. Michael squinted as Alicia tried to dodge the white rays, spinning around to search the rails. Cops, some 20 yards behind. Tossing their backpacks beneath the car, they set off. Michael in the lead, cutting corners, jumping tracks. They had run before and they knew the course. At the border of the yard in Confluence Park, Alicia climbed a chain-link fence, otherworldly, lithe, as though she'd lift into the sky and join the stars. But she only fell back to earth, a quick slap on dead grass. They ran on, keeping pace as two male voices hollered for them to do something like give up, to lay over, to end it. Alicia imagined hounds were tracking them. She stuck out her leg, tripping Michael. Before he could utter a word, she was on top of him, removing her scarf and unzipping her jacket. She pulled her sweater above her breasts and unhooked her bra. "Just shut up," she whispered. "Don't say shit." She cupped Michael's hands in hers, guiding them along her stomach, shivering at the chilled smoothness of his palms. She let go, feeling his hands gliding lower to her center. She arched her body upward, her back bending in a kind of release. The flashlight's beam reappeared as two policemen stood at the top of a hillside, witnessing Alicia with the sides of her puffy coat flung open like a gutted animal. Michael lay silent, pinned between her legs. Alicia breathed, waited. The policeman arrived.
"What are you doing?" they said. "Cover yourself."
Alicia snapped around and began to cry. They were no older than 20. Young men with unremarkable faces, one white and blonde, the other brown and short. Maybe a boy with a name like Mendoza. Perhaps a cousin of a cousin. When the blonde officer ordered the couple to stand, Alicia rolled onto her feet, inspecting her hands for paint. She then flashed her left hand, a rock sparkling more than any badge. "I'm so embarrassed," she said, as Michael stood beside her. "We were on a night walk celebrating. We're having our first baby." The same officer asked Michael if this was true.
"Yes, sir. Proud Papa got carried away."
"Carried away?" the shorter one asked now. He looked at Alicia's boots, a thin spot of navy paint across the right tip. She moved that leg behind the other.
"Did you see anyone come by?"
"No," they both uttered at once.
But then again, Michael said, we weren't really looking. The officers asked for IDs, though didn't seem surprised when neither Michael nor Alicia could produce one. Look, the blonde said, congratulations on your baby. I got two myself, little girls. But that doesn't mean you can publicly do whatever you were doing.
Of course, said Alicia. I was just so, I don't know, moved.
We get it, said the shorter one. You were carried away, moved. What's your name, ma'am?
Stephanie. I'm Stephanie Elkhorn. And this is my husband, Gary.
Alicia wouldn't look at Michael, even as she felt him glaring at her. This is a warning. You're one and only. Get your things and get out of here. With that, the policemen turned around and marched up the hill, the metal on their boots and hats flickering with moonlight.
Michael and Alicia stood quietly, the city's skyline enclosing them like a lid. They walked the long way back to the Nova, and after several blocks, Michael turned to Alicia. He touched her face, kissed her cheek. He thanked her for saving them. Alicia imagined him like those sea creatures she'd heard about but would never see. They were so far down, in complete darkness, translucent, their guts exposed like broken clocks.
It wouldn't just be more of you, he said. It'd be more of Gary. More of you both.
Michael then zipped Alicia's coat and reached for her scarf, lightly threading it behind her neck. Alicia del Toro Parker, I can't see you anymore. For her 30th birthday, Gary took Alicia to the cabin on the acres he owned in southern Colorado, near where her family was from in the San Luis Valley, where she'd spent her summers as a kid, where her father was buried. The cabin sat high in the valley, overlooking the sculpted mounds of desert earth. The weather had picked up, an autumn weekend that felt like late spring. Low-slung clouds crept above, their shape-shifting shadows trailing over the white peaks of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. The land was aflame. It was late. They drank gin and tonics outside near a large fire. Alicia had come off her week-long break from drinking, and the booze ran swiftly through her veins. Gary reclined in a wicker chair. Alicia sat across from him. Gazing into the sky, she stood then and stepped away from the fire. She held her drink with one hand and, with the other, pointed to the stars. Cain, behind her, licked the backs of her knees. Alicia hardened her stance, placing her free hand on the dog's collar. She thought of the goddess Diana. She thought of the moon.
What are you looking at, Allie Bird? Gary said.
I've always been able to find the North Star. It was one of those things my dad taught me so that I'd never get lost. What does it mean that I can't find it tonight?
It means you're drunk, birthday girl, Gary laughed, signaling high above them.
The sky was hazed with the dust of a billion stars, a black void that seemed designed yet eternal. Like a small sun, the fire's heat pressed into Alicia, warming her face and arms. She took off her sweater, dropping it to the ground. In the distance, above the dirt road into town, headlights curved along a mountainside, traveling into the dark. There were the sounds of the crackling fire, Alicia's heavy heartbeat, Kane's breathing loudly beside her. The wind shifted as a rush of embers jumped from the flames. Alicia kneeled down to her dog, shielding her watery eyes from smoke. There it is, she lied. I can see it now.
Ghost Sickness. Read for you by Roxana Ortega. Anna sits in a long classroom with many windows and a dated green chalkboard. The room is half empty. It's summer, and enrollment is low for history sections at the university. Lecturer Samantha Brown stands beneath the clock's black hands. She's young with a PhD from an East Coast school Anna has never heard of. An interesting anecdote about Leadville, says Brown, is the tale of two brothers, one living, one dead. In 1875, while digging the dead brother's grave, the living brother struck a silver vein. He immediately left his dead brother's body to freeze in a snowbank and claimed the mine. To prepare for the final, Brown is reviewing the entirety of the course, from Lewis and Clark to fur traders and national parks. She's now on silver booms. Anna's notebook is crammed with notes, her blue ink handwriting sloppier with each passing minute. She is in her usual seat, in the back, near the windows. What this story demonstrates is the absolute depravity of the West. Brown writes the word depravity on the green chalkboard. She circles it. Think about that. A student seated in the front row named Colleen raises her hand. I mean, isn't that illegal? Brown graciously answers Colleen's question with a comment on lawlessness. Anna sifts through her backpack, discreetly pulling her cell phone onto her lap, checking for a message from Clifton. Nothing. Only a text from Mom. Haven't heard from C. Had a job for him. Dinner tonight? Anna responds. She shifts in her seat and glances outside. The normally green city is brown with drought. An eyeshadow blue sky. A dusty film negative of trees. Anna hopes it rains soon, but more than anything, she hopes that her boyfriend, wherever he is, comes home. Last Thursday, Clifton said he was visiting his grandparents near Shiprock in New Mexico, a windy flatland marked by winged rocks and cloud-like sheep. There's no cell service in their corner of the reservation, a convenient excuse because Clifton often disappears. He has a problem with weariness, a tendency to binge. But that's Clifton, slippery like a fish. Mom pushes past Anna with an armful of paper grocery sacks. She stands on her daughter's stone stoop in her maroon scrubs with uneven sweat marks beneath the arms. She is heavy, solid. Despite her heft, or possibly because of it, her face is beautiful, with sharp lines along her jaw and cheeks. She has brought Anna three bags of frozen tortillas, a rinsed-out lard bucket of beef stew, and six bananas. Anna hugs Mom with more force than usual. Mom says, I'm sick of you so skinny. Don't you ever eat? Yeah, lots of student union frozen burritos. Where's Clifton, anyway? He's picking up extra shifts at the restaurant. Anna lies, lifting a sack of groceries. I had a couple jobs for him around the house, sod to move, bathroom needs painting. Mom invents these tasks for Clifton, a way to look after Anna. She wasn't happy when 2 years earlier, Anna and Clifton moved in together. A girl shouldn't shack up, she had said. You'll age quickly. But Mom once cared for Clifton more than Anna did. At 11, he moved next door with his uncle Virgil after his parents were killed on the reservation in a drunken brawl over $17. Mom felt sorry for him then. He often followed her around as she did housework. Tell me another story, Clifton would ask Mom as she Windexed and swept. Now, when I was a little girl, my tia brought me to an arroyo in Montrose, where everyone knew the lake monster lived. Anna, always sick of these dingy tales, didn't stick around to listen. The women make dinner in the dry warmth of the apartment, a one-bedroom brick box from the late 50s with no air conditioning. Heat drifts upward from the oak floors. Mom shares the latest gossip. Would you believe it? Grocery shopping for this very meal, She left her cart in line and walked off in search of batteries. When she returned, an Anglo woman accused her of cutting in line.
Oh, it had to be less than a minute, and I had already been there forever, so this woman tells me. I didn't see you at all. Can you believe that?
Mom shakes her head while chopping onions. She changes the subject, looking hard at her daughter.
How's school, mija?
Fine, says Anna, carrying glasses of sun tea to the wobbly table.
Are you worried about a class?
Just history. None of the dates stick. Everything blurs.
You better get yourself some flashcards.
Mom laughs, salting her frying pork. You can't fail another class. Anna knows this. If she fails, she'll lose her scholarship, the displaced fund, given to the grandchildren of Denver residents, mostly Hispano, who once occupied the West Side neighborhood before it was plowed to make way for an urban campus. Then she'll lose her work-study job at the library. After that, Anna will be back home with Mom.
I'm trying, she says. Hard.
What kind of history class, anyway?
History of the American West.
Mom smiles with gapped teeth. How the hell you gonna fail that? Anna laughs. You know history was never my favorite subject. Later that night, when she's alone in the apartment, Anna's cell phone rings with a blocked number. She answers, drowsy with bad dreams. There's only the electric chirp of static between satellites. It must be Clifton, no one else.
I know it's you, Anna says, propping her body upright against pillows, the room's darkness a blanket of fog. If she could just force him to speak, pull his voice through the phone.
When they were kids, Clifton hid for hours in cupboards, beneath stairwells, inside coat closets, anywhere he could disappear. Little hands sticking out from little cracks in doors.
Mom wants us to come down for lunch, Anna would say. This isn't funny anymore.
Anna says into the phone, rent's due Thursday. The amber glow of a street lamp shines into their bedroom, working its way through the Venetian blinds. Bars of light drop in rows, some of it resting against Clifton's tilted dresser drawers, some of it worming along Anna's face and long black hair. She imagines it's Clifton's breath, warm and sticky, in her ear.
Come home, baby. Please.
At the William H. Moffett Library, Anna clocks in at 11:30, checking with her supervisor about the day's tasks, and then ventures into the stacks with a cart of periodicals and children's books. She has prepared a study sheet, occasionally glancing at it between cartloads of books. Otter Mears, Railroad Entrepreneur, 1840 to 1931. Baby Doe Tabor, found dead in a Leadville cabin, ordered diamond pajamas for her toddler. Chief Ure, signed dubious treaties with whites. Anna closes her eyes, tests herself, forgets. After an hour of shelving, she takes a 10-minute break, walking alongside the Museum of Houses at the center of campus, tiny but elegant Victorians once occupied by families with names like Garcia, Santos, Rios. Anna remembers stories from her grandparents, how the block was alive with sounds of screeching children running sleek in leather booties, their marbles blasting across sandstone sidewalks. Come wash up, their young mothers would say, waving aprons like cotton flares. Your papas will be home soon. When Anna returns to the library, she spots Colleen and another girl from history class studying on the second floor near the magazines. They are both blonde with sharp features and lengthy ivory necks. Anna often wonders about students like Colleen, Denver newcomers with trust funds and loft apartments. They came with the tech jobs and legalization of weed, the great green rush, Anna thinks. Clifton says they aren't too bad. They have nice apartments with new paint, all their cars run, and they rarely speak to you in public. Two worlds in one space. The longer they stay, however, the more Anna worries that their world is collapsing her own. She tries avoiding the girls and slips behind a stack of government publications.
Hanna, right?
Colleen stands behind Anna, goofy with chapped lips. Anna corrects her, placing a golf magazine on the rack.
Ready for the final?
As much as I can be.
Tina and I actually wanted to ask you a question.
Colleen points behind her, the other girl's light eyes dropped to a cell phone screen.
You always wear such neat turquoise jewelry. Are you from Colorado, like a Native American?
I don't know, really. It's complicated. What about you?
I'm from Vermont, says Colleen. Ever been?
Anna shakes her head. Maple syrup? Snow? Colleen smiles with gummy teeth. She nods enthusiastically.
Mountains, too. Little ones, though.
Whenever I picture those faraway states, says Anna, returning to her shelving, I think of white people and dead witches.
Anna laughs and watches as Colleen's eyes narrow in confusion.
Kidding. After work, the apartment windows are open, a warm dusk breeze scattering papers like white doves. Anna leans in the doorway, examining the mess. From inside the bedroom, the radio sounds. It'll be a real scorcher this week, folks. Keep those animals indoors. Hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. None of the screens are slashed, and everything is in its right place. Anna's textbooks, Clifton's old bike, the Edward Curtis prints fixed to the fridge, the sterling and turquoise jewelry from Mom hidden inside the closet. There's also a stack of bills on the nightstand. Rent money. Not half like Clifton usually pays, all of it. Anna runs her hands along the empty bed. A drowning sense of dread hits her face like dirt, slowly until she feels buried. She tries his number twice, the phone dead each time. Maybe the money wasn't from Clifton. Maybe it was Mom. Who knows? Anna does know one thing. She'd rather not sleep alone tonight.
God damn you.
Anna whispers, and packs a bag for Mom's. The house is silent, apart from buzzing appliances and the muted drafts of Mom's snores. She lives in the suburbs, in a ranch-style home off Wadsworth Boulevard. A decade ago, she sold her bungalow on the north side to a young attorney couple from Philadelphia. They immediately painted the yellow house gray, marking it unrecognizable to anyone from the past.
Didn't Luisa Garcia once live here? Wasn't this block the Hispanic or Italian side of town?
No one asks questions like this anymore. No one remembers, and no one cares. In the guest bedroom, Anna strips, dropping her clothes where she stands. She slides into the bed with its brass frame originally from her grandparents. Anna holds the brass for a long moment, her palms picking up a metallic scent like blood. She then moves her hands along her sweat-slicked body, neck to thighs. Years ago, in this bed, Clifton reached behind Anna's back, tossing aside her long hair as he fumbled with bra straps. Mom was at work. The bedroom door was open. Anna was 16, newly in love. She folded her arms, revealing, as if suddenly, her full moon breasts. With a hungry mouth, Clifton kissed her cusps and held her tightly in each hand.
You make me feel full, he told her more than once. I'm heavy with you.
Morning. Anna kisses Mom's cheek as she stands before the kitchen sink, peering out the window at the brittle lawn. A crystal prism dangles, rainbowless and still. There's oatmeal in the pantry. Mom's dark eyes search the backyard. A blue jay dives from the sky, bumping against a waterless birdbath, knocking its beak into cement before fluttering away. They say it's supposed to get even hotter this week. Anna grabs a banana and takes a seat at the table. Who says that? The weather people. They say it's the worst drought in 400 years. Mom turns away from the window. She sits at the table with perfect posture, carrying her weight like armor, wearing a string of Bisbee turquoise lying just so across her breasts. All you're having is a banana? You'll disappear, Hita. Have some eggs. I'll fry them for you. Anna lets her mother cook for her. She watches as Mom removes the carton of brown eggs from the fridge, cracking them lightly into a white bowl. As she whisks, Mom's hands curve along her thumbs, meeting wide, capable palms. Anna loves her mother's hands, their roadmap lines and graceful nails. Why aren't you at your apartment? Mom looks over her shoulder. Did you miss my cooking? Anna considers telling Mom the truth, that Clifton is gone again, that this time is longer than ever before. But Mom can be kinder than Anna and more perceptive. She'll call into work, searching the worst motels, the darkest bars, anywhere she can think of, all the places Clifton tends to hide. I was hungry and I have no groceries, and it's really hot and I have no air conditioning. Or, says Mom, perhaps you're stressed about some silly class. You must have inherited your memory from a white man. She laughs and laughs again. Oh, that's right. You did. Mom often jokes about Anna's long-gone dad, a white guy from Texas, the one who left before she was born, the man who had said to get rid of it if you're smart. Mom serves Anna a plate of fried eggs with two corn tortillas. She then reaches above the hutch where she keeps her nursing diploma and framed pictures of Anna. She pulls down a cedar box, opens it to reveal a beaded purse. Do you remember your great-grandfather, Desiderio? Anna remembers a few fragments of great-grandpa Desi. The fuzzy way her face reflected in his glasses, his warm skin, waxy and cracked, the fragrance of his tobacco and Old Spice, the lullaby sounds of his languages, Spanish and something else. He died when I was so little, Mom. It doesn't have to be a story memory, she says. It can be a picture, a feeling. Mom is seated sideways in her chair, her abundant form curved outward. She wears her lilac scrubs, her hair braided with a matching purple ribbon to show solidarity for one cause or another, maybe war veterans or victims of mass shootings. This was his. It carried tobacco for ceremony. Anna lifts the old-fashioned purse from the table, surprised by its weightiness. You know, Mom says, Clifton once told me this purse depicts the emergence, the place where our people crawled out of the earth. It's down south, near the San Juan Mountains. Anna examines the purse. It has four mountains in white, blue, yellow, and black. She rubs her fingers over the center. A row of beads loosens. You come from this land, Hita. Remembering that might help you with your little history class. Ghost sickness, says Brown, is a culture-bound syndrome of the Navajo and other southwestern tribes. She speaks with pink gum in her tight mouth. Taken out of its cultural context, the illness doesn't exist. Anna takes notes in blue ink
only occasionally drifting to the notebook's margin to draw spirals and little eyeballs with long lashes. "Imaginary illness," she writes, "comes after abrupt slash violent death of loved one, marked by loss of appetite, sense of fear, extreme cases, hallucinations."
If one were to go to the doctor today with these symptoms, you'd have what's known as anxiety or depression. Modern medicine handles it without all-night dances and prayer ceremonies, says Brown sarcastically.
Colleen raises her hand.
Will this be on the final?
Brown scratches her left eyebrow, smearing her pen's ink across her cheek.
"No, Colleen," she says. "But as extra credit, I often ask a question related to Native Americans."
Anna scribbles down the words, "extra credit." She keeps her pen moving, as if memory were dependent upon constant motion. The study guide on her desk reads more like a contract than a learning supplement. What happened at Sand Creek? What land did Juan de Ulibarri claim for Spain? What caused the Pueblo Revolt of 1680? Anna knows these things. She swears it. With the revolt, the Spanish burned the masks, the prayer sticks, the beaded purses. There is something about every man in the pueblos having his right foot sawed off. There is an image of wet blood dripping from meat and bone into dry sand. There are prayer songs lost forever in the gutted throats of the massacred. Anna raises her hand, surprising even herself.
"Yes," Brown says, searching her class list. "Erica, you have a question?"
"Anna. I'm Anna Garcia," Brown apologizes. She asks Anna to continue.
"The Pueblo Revolt of 1680, wasn't there a drought then, too?"
Brown is silent as she looks downward, rotating her watch band.
"Anna, it'd be wise to follow along. I'm essentially giving you the answers, and right now we're discussing the Land Act of 1820.
Anna murmurs an apology. She tips her gaze toward her lap. For the remainder of class, Brown lectures, answers appropriate questions, and shakes her head, "No, not quite," when a front row student compares the cliff dwellings of Mesa Verde to the grandeur of Notre Dame. Anna sits before the television on her hardwood floor, her history textbook open between her sticky legs. On the news, there is talk of brush fires and an elderly man found dead on his sofa. Heat exhaustion, the newspeople say. No one noticed he hadn't left the place in days, but the stench, the neighbor woman complained, was awfully ripe, like the smell of a deer crushing against her headlights 4 years earlier. Anna nervously bites the insides of her cheeks until she tastes blood. She attempts to study while the room turns from day to night. The walls glow violet. The floor disengages into gray. Anna paces in the dark, calling Clifton repeatedly, losing track of time. An empty feeling grows inside her until she decides to turn it off. The bathwater steams, blurring the mirror above the sink. Anna wipes through the distortion. She has carried candles from her bedroom, one vanilla and the other of St. Michael, placing them at the corners of the tub. The water is rose-colored beneath pink-tiled walls. All summer, Anna has avoided baths and their heat, but tonight she eases into the tub, submerging her face as long as her lungs can stand. Beneath the water, Anna hears far-off dings and ticks. She hears the scraping of sand, the pull of soil. From above, she imagines she is small, her dark hair widening in inky tendrils. That's when she sees Clifton. He is driving the narrow mountain pass between Silverton and Ouray, the million-dollar highway, a road once thought impossible to build, the cliffs too steep, the land forsaken. It's deep into the night. The pavement is bone dry as Clifton tilts left, then right, along the corkscrew path. He is going very fast in a Ford pickup, a Cyclops with one headlight. The truck hugs several bends in the road. A black bear, dopey and confused, emerges from the shadowed tree line. Clifton swerves, the drop into the gulch unmeasurable in real time. Thousands of feet, the tiny pickup plunges. Thousands of feet, Clifton tumbles into the canyon below, into the beginning world of darkness. The pickup resembles a falling star as it sinks into the earth. In a violent rush, Anna forces herself up from beneath the water's wall. Her left hand is tilted over the tub's brim, her wrist and fingers leaking onto the white and black checkered floor. She gasps, the sound of her lungs echoing throughout the candlelit bathroom. For several moments, her tender chest swells with damp air. She begins to cry. Anna knows, as certain as she is alive, that Clifton is dead. She allows this sense to search wider, a feeling so vast it could move above cities, across prairies, along granite rocks, plunging headlong into the cool ground. With her left foot, Anna knocks loose the rubber plug, leaning back as the water flows forward.
"I'm scared," she says later, calling Mom. "I think Clifton's gone."
"I don't want to see anything," says Brown. "Only the test and your pencils. No cell phones, no extra paper." She writes the exam start and end times on the green chalkboard. She has advised students to return their completed tests face down on her podium by 45 after. Brown walks the aisles in modest clogged sandals, laying finals one by one across each desk.
"I wish you the best of luck, and I hope your studying pays off."
Brown strolls toward the back windows. Anna glances outside one last time at the dead grass, the expanse of birch trees. There is a sound like falling ice as dusty blinds cover the classroom windows. The test is what Anna expects. Multiple choice for hundreds of questions, A, B, C, or D. Nothing more, nothing less. The cast of characters is lengthy and time is vacant. What year was the Homestead Act? Which religious group settled the West to avoid persecution? Who became known as Boy General? Anna watches the backs of her classmates' heads, dreams of their answers, their clarity of thought. She finds herself tapping her pencil over letters, guessing far too many times. She shakes her legs. She ties and unties her hair, sweeps fallen strands from her desk onto the carpeted floor. Soon students rise from their seats, turning their tests in to Brown with triumphant looks. Anna remains. She continues to guess. Colleen rises from her chair, heading to the front of the classroom, her blonde head held high as a war horse's. She whispers a thank you to Brown and exits the classroom once and for all. When Anna tallies the number of answers she is certain are correct, the outcome isn't good. A dismal 15 or 20, another failing grade. And just when Anna throws her head down in a type of shame, she flips to the last page. Extra credit. For a full letter grade increase, in detail, describe the origin myth of the Navajo people. Clifton once held Anna's hair high above her neck. Front to back, they stood in the chilly light of their apartment bathroom, 1 week after moving in. Anna loved being with Clifton in their apartment. She loved him holding her body to his in that small white space. "Calm down, baby," he said. Anna couldn't stop crying, tears and snot streaming down her face in shiny pathways. With her eyes scrunched and her mouth twisted tight, Clifton laughed. All this, he told her,
Over a tick.
Where did you feel it again?
Right there, where your hand is.
Anna forced Clifton's left hand to the back of her right ear. She held him there, frantic and moaning. That morning had been good. They'd hiked El Dorado Canyon, awake with the first light of dawn. The aspen trees had turned, their golden leaves shimmering. Air felt virtuous to breathe, running through them as thrilling as their pulse, generating its own warmth, its own beat. They laughed and chased one another through narrow granite squeezes, running their palms along cold, wet rocks. They eventually slipped into the empty cavity of an old Forest Service shed, where they made love quickly and halfway clothed.
See it.
There, Clifton explained, tucked into the soft scoop behind Anna's right earlobe was the tick.
This little bastard thinks he's gonna suck my woman? Disrespectful as hell.
Anna bent forward.
Stop laughing. Get it off me. They cause Lyme.
Grab your hair while I get a match. She reached up with both hands, taking her hair from Clifton as he rummaged through the drawers, revealing a yellow pack of liquor store matches. He lit one and burned the needle. Clifton went toward Anna with the red tip.
You have to stand still, he said. If not, I'll miss the head.
Anna's legs trembled. She asked what happens then.
Nothing good. They can regrow a body inside you. In your heart.
Clifton laughed. Sorry, babe. Anna hyperventilated, shaking so much that removal was impossible. Clifton pleaded with her to calm down. He said it'd be quick. He told her to listen.
How about a story?
Anna said flatly.
A story? What?
You can pay attention to something else.
Clifton kissed Anna's shoulder, slick with fear.
Okay. So that buddy of mine, Taylor, and I were at McNard's Dive on Federal when this dude came in selling stolen TVs.
A bar story?
Anna did laugh, but only a little.
Well, excuse me. What do you want, a thriller?
Oh, a ghost story.
No, said Anna. Tell me something nice.
Clifton was quiet for some time, and Anna knew he had stories, some from Mom, some from his own life, some he couldn't quite shake. He said at last, wonderful and low,
how about a Dine story, the beginning of it all?
Go on, said Anna,
her legs slowing to a shudder.
You have to pay attention. The story has twists. Only in the end is there love.
And so Clifton told Anna the story of first man and first woman, how they were born of stardust and earth, scrambled out of the underground land of darkness and traveled through many worlds, leaving behind the blackness of their beginnings for a life of sunlight and air. Clifton removed the tick while Anna, soundless and peaceful, listened in such a way that she knew she'd remember every word for all her life.
And that, he said when they were finished, is our story of everything.
This is Roxana Ortega. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Sabrina and Karina, stories by Kali Fajardo Anstein. This program was directed by Harry Nangle. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2018 by Kali Fajardo Anstein. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.